The Guardian.
In the early 1980s, many thought epidemics were about to be a thing of the past. The decade started with the World Health Assembly declaring smallpox had been eradicated thanks to a global immunisation campaign. And similar campaigns had greatly reduced the incidence of diseases like polio, mumps and measles in many parts of the world. And this led some scientists to think there might be soon an end to infectious diseases. But then, in 1981, a new epidemic appeared.
Acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS for short, was first identified about 18 months ago. The disease, which is almost always fatal, leads to a complete breakdown of the body's own natural defences, leaving the victim wide open to a rare form of terminal cancer and lethal bouts of infection.
There was still a lot of stigma within healthcare systems. People were treated quite horrendously in some hospitals because they were known to have AIDS.
Sadly, after 30 plus years, there is still a lot of stigma surrounding HIV and AIDS, and we still don't have a cure. But there is hope. A string of recent trials have been hailed as a big step to curbing an epidemic that has taken millions of lives, many belonging to gay men who are at disproportionately high risk of contracting the disease. The impact of the AIDS epidemic on the gay community has been hugely significant, both in terms of the toll it took on a generation of men and the activism that came in response to it. This month is Pride Month, and so on Science Weekly, we want to look back at the history of HIV, the stigma, the misinformation, and the role that science has played. We also want to look forward to the promising drug trials and whether the UK government can fulfil its 2019 commitment to stop new HIV transmissions in England by 2030.
If you're on the drugs, you are not going to transmit HIV infection to anybody else. So there's an obvious consequence of that. If you can get everybody with HIV infection on treatment, it will not only save their lives, but it will stop the transmission of the disease straight away.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
I'm Alex Sparrowhawk and I'm HIV Prevention England Programme Officer at Terence Higgins Trust.
I started by asking Alex what HIV is.
HIV stands for Human Immunodeficiency Virus, and it's a virus that attacks the immune system of the body, in particular what's known as CD4 cells, which form the immune response within the body, and it infects these cells and during the replication process actually kills them. And that can lead to someone having a weakened immune system, and ultimately, if left untreated, they'll develop a number of different conditions, and that can lead to what's known as AIDS, which is acquired immunodeficiency syndrome.
And at what point do you make the transition between those two things? Like, what point does it get counted as AIDS?
Yeah, so there's different definitions of what AIDS actually is. In the UK, we'd normally be giving someone an AIDS diagnosis when their CD4 counts, the amount of the CD4 cells, the immune response in the body, falls below 200 copies per milliliter of blood. And they'd also have to have what's known as an AIDS-defining condition, so something like PCP, a type of pneumonia, and various forms of cancers and that sort of thing. We often talk about late-stage HIV now, or advanced HIV instead of AIDS in the UK, but it's still a term that globally is used a lot.
When did the medical world first become aware of the significance of HIV and AIDS?
So HIV wasn't discovered as a virus for many years, actually, after they started to find people who were basically experiencing symptoms of the condition. And it was actually in 1981 that an article was published that described gay men who all had the same type of pneumonia and had similar types of cancer. And essentially they realised there was something going on behind the scenes, that this wasn't just normal pneumonia or a normal type of cancer in the population. This was something very specific that was being transmitted within a population that initially was thought just to be affecting gay men. And they coined the term GRID, or gay-related immunodeficiency. And that kind of led to a lot of stereotyping in the early days that this was something that just affected gay men. There was still a lot of stigma within healthcare systems. People were treated quite horrendously in some hospitals because they were known to have AIDS. And that's really one of the reasons why Terence Higgins Trust was set up in 1982. It was named after Terry Higgins, and his partner and his friends wanted to set up the charity in his name in the UK to make sure that other people didn't have to go through the experiences that they'd gone from. They could support people who were dying of AIDS to die comfortably as possible.
Terence Higgins was one of the first people to die of an AIDS-related illness in the UK. Following his death in 1982, Higgins's partner, Rupert Whittaker, helped to found the Terence Higgins Trust. At the time, there was still much confusion and stigma around AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or what some people wrongly and shockingly called the gay plague, or GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency. Groups like the Terence Higgins Trust and the Gay Medical Association pushed back against this, providing support to those with HIV and education to those without it. Around the same time, scientists were finally able to isolate and identify HIV as the cause of AIDS and demonstrated that it wasn't just gay men who were at risk.
I mean, initially, it really was sort of like all hands on deck, but it was really difficult to determine what was happening. Lots of research was put into these people that were really, really ill and suffering quite sort of like horrendous conditions. And it really was just the determination of scientists globally around the world to figure out what was going on. And once the virus was discovered and a test was able to be developed, they were then able to roll that out and find people. Of course, in the early days in the 80s as well, there wasn't actually any treatment.
Because there wasn't yet a treatment, the government focused on prevention. Margaret Thatcher's health secretary, Norman Fowler, launched a huge public information campaign in 1987 called Don't Aid AIDS. Although, according to Fowler, his PM was not a natural supporter.
You will have seen that the major booklet which we got out, which tells you a great deal about it, you will have seen some of the advertisements in the press. Government can't stop you from getting AIDS, but most people could stop themselves.
This came following years of mounting pressure on politicians by gay activists and members of the scientific and medical communities, who organised and lobbied around one simple message. This could affect straight people too. They will be prepared. And while these measures did lead to greater awareness of the disease, effective therapies didn't appear until 1995, when a combination of drugs was approved for use in the US. These were known as highly active antiretroviral therapy, or HART, and a similar approach is still used today.
Antiretroviral medication stops HIV from replicating in the body. And there's a number of different classes and they work in different ways. Some of them stop the virus from actually binding to a CD4 cell. Others stop the replication of the genetic material, the viral RNA, from being able to be replicated within the cell itself. And others block things like proteins being made that stops the virus from being able to replicate and bud and essentially produce millions more copies of itself.
So scientists and doctors have made huge strides in being able to treat HIV, and people these days are able to live a completely normal, healthy, active life. But nevertheless, a lot of people would prefer not to be taking a drug every day of their life if there was an alternative. And scientists have been working on, you know, possible alternatives. So one case that's really caught people's imagination is the Berlin patient, and there have been updates on that. Could you tell us a bit about what that case involved and why that was exciting in terms of a potential treatment?
Yeah, so the Berlin patient was someone called Timothy Brown, who was living with HIV but also had a very rare and severe type of cancer. And whereas HIV treatment can stop the replication of the virus in bodily fluids, the HIV virus still resides in body tissues. And essentially, as a sort of side effect of a bone marrow transplant he underwent to treat the cancer, they actually found that the HIV had been eradicated or repressed within the tissue as well. And essentially, he was cured. He doesn't have to take HIV treatment any longer. However, it's not something that people have been able to replicate. It's an extremely dangerous procedure. People die from this procedure when they're undergoing it because of treatment for cancer. And to put it in perspective, the closest that we've had to it is a similar operation undergone to someone who lived in London more recently in the past 18 months or so. So it's taken a decade to kind of find a second person where that's even similar circumstances are under. It's not something that anyone living with HIV day to day could undergo or would want to.
As Alex alludes to, this treatment is rare, and it's certainly not going to be what brings about an end to the epidemic. But one thing that people have got really high hopes about is a therapy known as pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, which was approved for use in the US in 2012. As the name suggests, this is a more proactive approach, which is taken by HIV-negative people who might be at risk of contracting HIV.
It doesn't act like a barrier method in the same way that a condom does, but it means that if any of the virus was to get into their body, there's enough of those HIV medication in their system to stop it from replicating, so it can't get a foothold within there and the virus essentially just dies. And we know it's really helping to reduce new diagnosis where there's access to it. In the UK at the moment, that differs from between the different nations. In England, you're only able to access PrEP at the moment if you buy it yourself online and import it, or if you've got access to the IMPACT trial, which has different sites in sexual health clinics across the country. But those spaces have been filling up really fast and demand's been quite high to get on the trial, particularly amongst gay and bisexual men.
Alex, what's the status of HIV in the UK today? How many people do we know are infected, and what's the rate of diagnosis? How many new diagnoses are there each year?
So we know in the UK now that there are about 100,000 people living with HIV, and most of them are aware of their status, so they're being seen in care and they're taking treatment. We do know, though, that about 7,800 of those aren't aware of their diagnosis, and these are the people that we're trying to reach when we're carrying out HIV testing in clinics or GPs and community settings. We've seen quite a substantial decline in new diagnosis in the most recent years. Between 2017 and 2018, there was an 18% fall in new diagnosis, and that's really down to effective HIV treatment and increases in HIV testing.
It's heartening to hear the progress that scientists have made in fighting HIV. But despite these advances, there were over 4,000 new HIV diagnoses in the UK in 2017. Earlier this year, the UK government announced it would try to eradicate new HIV infections in England by 2030. But how?
So, you know, we are there if we can get the treatment to all those people who are infected.
We'll be back in a minute after the break.
The Voice Lab from The Guardian.
Hey, do you ever want a quick catch-up on the news headlines first thing in the morning while you're making breakfast or getting dressed? Well, if you have a Google Assistant or Google Home, we can help with that. The Guardian Briefing is an experiment from The Voice Lab, which in under 2 minutes brings you up to speed with what you need to know about the day's top stories. We'll make sure you don't miss a thing. To listen at any time, just say, "Hey Google, speak to the Guardian Briefing."
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard about the huge progress in curbing the HIV epidemic. In a large part, this was thanks to the efforts of the gay community, the kind of solidarity which is being celebrated this month during Pride. Even today, though, there is no cure, and so much of the focus continues to be on prevention. And last month, there was a paper in The Lancet confirming that the drugs available today can completely stop people with HIV transmitting the virus to others. Many have hailed this as the beginning of the end. I wanted to find out more, so I invited my colleague Sarah Bosley in for a chat. Sarah is The Guardian's health editor.
This is a trial called the Partner Trial, and it's actually the development of a trial that began in 2014. So the first results were in 2016, and that was amongst heterosexual couples, so a man and a woman, one of whom had HIV and the other didn't. And what has happened is that the person who has HIV has treatment, antiretroviral treatment, as everybody does or should have if they are reached with it. And that suppresses the virus so far in their body to such low levels that it becomes untransmissible. That's what the trial has proved. And the first results were in 2016 and showed that in around 900 couples, in fact, there was zero transmission. So nobody at all picked up HIV from their HIV-infected partner. So the latest trial, the results of which were very recent, is the extension of that into gay couples. You had one man who was HIV positive and his partner who was not. And the man who was HIV positive was on antiretroviral treatment, and their virus was suppressed to such a low level again that, in fact, no transmissions happened at all. So nobody actually got HIV as a result of sex with their partner who was on antiretroviral drugs.
There were a few men that were newly diagnosed who were on the trial, which, you know, on the face of it, you might start worrying that it wasn't completely effective, but why was that?
There were 15 men who were infected with HIV during the course of this trial, but in all those cases, it was figured out that in fact they'd had sex with somebody else, not actually with their partner who was on the drugs and therefore wasn't infectious.
And how has the medical community responded to this study? Because it just gives so much confidence in the idea that you're able to stop the spread of HIV.
Well, there has been huge enthusiasm for this ever since the first results in 2016. Because, of course, what it means is that, you know, if you're on the drugs, you are not going to transmit HIV infection to anybody else. So there's an obvious consequence of that. If you can get everybody with HIV infection on treatment, it will not only save their lives, but it will stop the transmission of the disease straight away. You know, there will be no more virus moving about the planet. So the thought of that is phenomenal. And there has been massive enthusiasm in the medical community, also amongst the campaigners, clearly, the AIDS activists, everybody. So this trial, because it's 4 years down the line, 4 or 5 years down the line from the first results, people are simply saying, wow, that's fantastic. And it proves it. You know, finally, there can be no more discussion. It happens not only in heterosexual couples, but also in homosexual gay couples. So, you know, we are there if we can get the treatment to all those people who are infected.
The other if is that we need to make sure that everyone who is infected knows they are infected. Remember how Alex said there are over 7,000 people in the UK who don't know they've got HIV. Those people could be transmitting the virus to others unknowingly.
The other thing everybody has been talking about is test and treat. That's another mantra, if you like. That's what you need to do. So you need to have everybody diagnosed. And in the UK, 43% of people are diagnosed late with HIV. And that is when they've been obviously infected for some time, you know, maybe a year, maybe 6 months. But during that time, they have been able to pass it on to somebody else because they didn't know they were infected. So they won't have necessarily been taking precautions, using condoms, and they certainly won't be on treatment. So a late stage diagnosis is bad news. And we need to do something about that. But there is still a lot of stigma around HIV. So people are reluctant to go for testing. And they rather assume, keep their fingers crossed, that they're not HIV positive. And it has been suggested, actually, by a few doctors that there should be absolutely routine testing, certainly for anybody who goes to an STI clinic. Because if you're picking up sexually transmitted infections from, you know, chlamydia to syphilis to gonorrhea, you could also be picking up HIV. So that would be one way of doing it, making it absolutely normal for everybody to be tested.
In curbing the HIV epidemic, the PrEP approach is considered key by many campaigners. This is a drug that reduces the risk of someone becoming HIV positive, even if they have unprotected sex with someone who is. However, as Alex said before, access to these drugs is still limited in parts of the UK.
In the UK, the NHS actually has tried its best not to provide them for people routinely, and certainly not in the numbers that would need them or that could use them. And the reason for that is again, simply the cost. NHS England fought a court case against actually providing them to everybody who wanted them, saying that it wasn't their responsibility. It should be for the local authorities to pay for it rather than NHS England. So it was simply a money issue. And NHS England lost. But what they've done instead now is to launch a big trial. In the situation of a trial, they are able to use the generic version, which is a lot cheaper. So at the moment, you've got quite a lot of people who are in the trial and therefore accessing PrEP that way. But there are still people who are not getting it who would like to.
It's frustrating that sometimes those decisions are made on a per patient basis. You know, for that particular patient, it might not be cost effective, but it could be so powerful if you wanted to actually bring HIV transmission to an end completely, couldn't it?
Well, yes. I think in this case, it's rather a class decision, if you like, because it's a prophylaxis, because it's not actually a treatment for somebody. So you don't do it on a one-by-one basis. It's, you know, will this whole group of people who are having potentially risky sex be prevented from getting a disease that would then cost the NHS an awful lot of money? So it's been... It's a major decision that NHS England had to make. You know, were they going to provide it to everybody or to nobody? And their decision originally was, we can't afford to do this, so it'll have to be nobody. And hopefully the local authorities will pick up the tab.
It feels as though we now have the tools to end the epidemic, providing we diagnose people quickly, suppress the virus so it can't be transmitted, and make sure that those people who are at risk have access to PrEP drugs. All of which will be key if the UK government's commitment to end transmission of HIV in England by 2030 is to be met. But as Sarah and Alex said, challenges remain.
Yeah, the government has stated it wants to end new transmissions by 2030. I do think that is possible in the UK. But we do need to invest in our sexual health services. We need to make sure that we're targeting people who need to be tested. And we really need to reduce this number, even though it's already reduced dramatically, the number of people who aren't aware they have HIV yet. But without doing so, we still run the risk of there being new diagnoses. So essentially, we're stopping HIV from being the epidemic it was because people are taking the treatment. But in order to do that, they need to know that they have it.
Is there one thing at the moment that you can see as a major kind of sticking point in terms of what's available through health clinics or, you know, a sort of political sticking point? You know, if there's one thing that you could get politicians to change to try and meet this target, what would it be?
I think in the UK, it's definitely investment in sexual health services. We're seeing increased demand. More people want to attend clinics. We know more people are being turned away, though. And this isn't just about HIV. It's in general sexual health. We know STIs like syphilis and gonorrhea are on the increase. We really need to ensure that there's that money within public health budgets to support those services to be able to test people. And we also need to ensure that support and prevention services from voluntary and charitable organisations are also supported, because we know that not everyone wants to go to a hospital to have a test. And it's important that there is a different range of options available. We're really lucky in the UK that for things like HIV, you can actually do a test at home now. You can get a result within 15 minutes. And it's those kind of interventions that have really paved the way to more and more people taking HIV tests and finding out their status if they do have it and being able to access the treatment.
Many thanks to Alex Sparrowhawk and Sarah Bosley for joining us this week. If you've got any comments, thoughts, or suggestions about anything you've heard, send them over. Our email is scienceweekly@theguardian.com. If you'd like to read more about the latest research on HIV, we'll include a link to some of Sarah's writing in the episode's description on the Guardian website. The programme was produced by Greya Jackson. I'm Hannah Devlin. Until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.